indicate something of Jacob's discernment of his son's character, but also there is a prophetic element as he has spoken of the blessing that God plans and intends for them and for their offspring in the days that lie ahead. Well then, verse 29. Then he gave them these instructions. I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of Machpelah, near Mamre in Canaan, which Abraham bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite, along with the field. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave in it were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. When the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, if I have found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I am about to die. Bury me in the tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go and bury my father, then I will return. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear to do. So Joseph went up to bury his father. All Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of his court, and all the dignitaries of Egypt, besides all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and those belonging to his father's household. Only their children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company. When they reached the threshing floor of Atad near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly. And there Joseph observed a 7-day period of mourning for his father. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, the Egyptians are holding a solemn ceremony of mourning. That is why that place near the Jordan is called Abel Mizraim. So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which Abraham had bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite, along with the field. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury his father. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this public reading of his holy word. We're going to look at this passage somewhat differently from normal this evening. I'm going to comment on the first part, and then we will sing, and then I'll comment in the second part. I told my wife what I was planning to do this evening, and she said, do you mean that you're really just wanting to preach two sermons, and this is one way of slipping it into the service? And I assured her that this was not the case. It is one sermon in two parts. But if you will come, please, to Genesis chapter 49. The book of Ecclesiastes reminds us that there is a time for everything. There's a time to be born, and there is a time to die. There is a time to weep, and there is a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. But our society, it seems to me, is determined to deny much of what is inevitable about life, and in particular to deny the grim reality of death itself. It is the forbidden subject of the 20th century. And I think it's also true to say that contemporary society looks at death through a distorted lens. So that I believe that we in the church need to be aware of those distortions and to recover a biblical attitude towards death and bereavement. And the passage before us, which speaks of the mourning of Joseph towards the death of his father, helps do that and helps shape our response to death and to mourning. And I want to begin this evening by saying that societies can probably be categorized by their attitude towards death, and I'll touch on three different categories. First, there is the death-accepting attitude that was found in ancient Greece. Now, the ancient Greeks believed in the immortality of the soul, which they thought was essentially good and therefore permanent. But the body was material and therefore inherently evil and therefore perishable. The Greeks believed that death freed the soul from the prison of the body, and it was a liberating experience which was to be welcomed. As a student, I spent some time many years ago doing the classical tour of Greece, and I saw a number of ancient Greek tombstones on which one could find death depicted as a maiden beckoning the dead individual to enter into the fullness of this new and liberating experience. And these were very pleasant carvings. None of the skull and crossbones stuff, but a beautiful maiden saying, listen, life is about to begin for you. You're coming out of the prison of this awful body and into a quite marvelous and fulfilling existence. Now, Socrates, one of the chief exponents of this view, was happy, therefore, to drink a fatal draught of hemlock, because he saw death as a friend. Now, there is a twofold difficulty with this particular view. First of all, it rests on an untested philosophical hope. The ability to be able to face death with serenity does not in itself argue for the truth of the philosophy, because people can be sincerely and serenely wrong about death. Secondly, this attitude to death does not help the survivors. Plato, one of Socrates' star pupils, had nothing at all to comfort him in the loss of his mentor. And all he could do was attempt to accept Socrates' death with a tight-lipped stoicism, grin and bear it. Death-accepting attitude. Secondly, there is a death-denying attitude, and this is certainly prevalent in our own post-Christian society. Richard Doss, in his book on death, describes what he calls a massive cultural conspiracy which is at work creating a new image for death. And we attempt to reshape our understanding of death by the language we use, particularly imaginative euphemisms, which we have invented to soften the reality of death. And he goes on to describe the way in which various professions speak of death. In hospital, the patient doesn't die, he expires. In the hands of the mortician, the dead person is described as the passing of a loved one. And even the minister speaks of our friend who has passed on. The local newspaper reporting the death reports it as someone who has passed away. And Doss continues, this is the accepted social practice of speaking of death. If you are so coarse as to mention, in a matter-of-fact way, did you hear that John Jones died last week? People think you to be in poor taste and indiscreet. Use of softened language indicates a strong need to deny the harshness of death. Why has our society become a death-denying one? Well, I want to suggest a number of reasons to you. First of all, there is surely our overexposure to it. I read recently that the average Western child who is exposed to TV sees more death before he or she goes to school than an adult of previous generations saw in all their lifetime. A second reason for our death-denying attitude is our current obsession with youthfulness and productivity. A person's worth is measured by his age. If you are 45 and made redundant, your chances of re-employment are extremely slim. You're over the hill. Old age is not respected, but despised. And this, in great measure, helps explain the popular appeal of gyms and spas and facelifts and health foods and the very latest face creams which prevent the skin from aging. Have you noticed that on television? The very latest face cream now prevents your skin from aging. It's a wonderful formula. But surely the principal cause of society's death-denying attitude is a religious one. First of all, our society has absorbed the philosophy of materialism, which believes that only this world is worth living for. And the logic of that position is that death terminates all that we are. And therefore, death is something that has to be pushed out to the boundaries of our consciousness. But secondly, if materialism is wrong, if God exists for the materialist, then death will usher us into his presence. And that is also something that men and women cannot bear to think about. For you see, in denying God, they have separated death from the very means by which it had previously been explained and made palatable to men and women. One writer has this to say, with no meaningful framework for understanding death, our culture has adopted a style of denial and avoidance. And this attitude of avoidance is summed up in Woody Allen's comment. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's not that I'm afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Avoidance. We can be death-accepting, death-denying, or a death-defying people. And this, I would submit to you, is the biblical position. It is the Christian one. It is certainly the attitude of the apostle. Listen to these words of defiance. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? That is facing death. Face-to-face encounter with death and saying, "O death, I defy you." And we'll sing of that presently. The Christian view acknowledges death's reality and horror on the one side, while recognizing a life beyond and a triumph over it on the other. Jacob shared this view as he prepared for his own death. You will remember that he had previously described himself to Pharaoh as a pilgrim in this life, and as a pilgrim who anticipated residence, the writer to the Hebrews tells us, residence in a city whose builder and maker is God. And perhaps one of the most striking things about Jacob's closing words is the directions he gives concerning his burial in Machpelah. Now, a modern story writer would have had Jacob buried not beside Leah, but beside Rachel on the road to Ephrath, not in that dark cave at Machpelah. This would have been a far more romantic ending to the story of Jacob, buried side by side with the woman he loved. Why didn't Jacob ask to be buried there? Why not beside his beloved wife? He wanted to be buried in the cave of his fathers, giving testimony not only to their common faith in God, but to the fact that life's goal was to be found not in this life, but in the life to come. It was Jacob's way of triumphantly saying, "I share the pilgrim faith of Abraham and of Isaac. I'm just passing through this life. I share their pilgrim faith. I'm looking forward to sharing with them in the blessings of God in eternity." And having given those final directions, Jacob drew his feet up into his bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Death defying, death was for him the beginning of newness of life. Now notice Joseph's response in verse 1 of chapter 50. He grieves over his father's death in a striking fashion. He shared his father's death-defying attitude. He knew of the blessings of God that awaited his father, perhaps not with the same clarity as men and women with New Testament understanding. But he knew of that. But here is the other side of death. Here is the soreness of separation. And he grieves for his father as he throws himself upon him and kisses him in death. Now, in our culture, where death is denied so strenuously, grief is often shunned, and to grieve visibly for any prolonged period is discouraged. I can remember visiting a young widow a month after her husband's death, and her friends were telling her to snap out of it, to pull herself together, to remember that she had the rest of her life to live. You see, they found her grief uncomfortable. It reminded them of the brevity of their own lives, and that was the one thing they wanted to forget. I was stunned to read recently that undertakers are reporting an increasing trend in funeral arrangements to get it over with as quickly as possible. and that more and more an impersonal third party is making all of the arrangements because the family don't want to be disturbed by the reality of death. Joseph was not so influenced. You will notice that the formal period of mourning lasted 70 days. Add to that a further period of time when he and his brothers took Jacob's body home for burial. Now, if someone was to mourn that length of time today, many would call it morbid. And they would seek to sedate or distract the mourner in some way. But listen, Joseph was one of the most self-possessed individuals in all of Scripture. And he grieves loudly and long. It is not unnatural to spend time grieving over someone who has been a part of our lives for many, many years. I've spoken to grieving spouses who have taken years to come to terms with their loss. And they would say something like this, I have lost a part of myself. And all of Joseph's preparations were means of honoring the memory and the wishes of his father. Joseph had his father's body embalmed, not because he was influenced by Egyptian funeral rites, but surely with the prospect of a long journey in view. It is not wrong, indeed it is actually beneficial for us to have funeral services in which we honor the memory of loved ones, in which we dispose of the body that was a part of them. Indeed, such services are often helpful for us as we affirm our defiance of death and at the same time begin to work through the grief process. We are going to affirm our defiance of death now as we sing together. Joseph did not grieve forever. Verse 14 of chapter 50 reminds us that he returned to Egypt. He got on with living. That is, after some 4 months of obvious bereavement. I want to suggest to you this evening that it would have been hard for Joseph to leave Canaan. Remember, he hadn't seen this land since he was a boy of some 17 years of age. This land was the focus of God's promises. It was the focus of God's future for Israel. But now Joseph sets out again for Egypt to resume life and to take up the responsibilities which were his. And those of us who have lost someone close to us need to be able to do something just like that. Perhaps not today or this week, or next month. For dealing with grief is something which can take a long period of time. But life must resume in full some day. And the knowledge of that, as well as our consciousness of moving towards that, is a part of what we might describe as the grief process. Now, we need to be aware of the process of grief, not only to equip us to deal with the loss of loved ones in our own situation, but in order to be able to help those who are engaged themselves in the process of bereavement. And bereavement is a process. It is a process that is made up of a number of stages. Each stage is not always obviously apparent. Some people wrestle with one stage more than others. But I feel that it is helpful for us and necessary for us to understand in some measure this process that I have described. The first stage has been identified as shock. In a long illness, that shock begins from the very time we learn of the terminal nature of a loved one's illness. There is a turmoil of conflicting emotions described by someone as having an egg beater thrust into the bowl of one's emotion. It's a very unsettling experience for those who have never yet experienced it. Secondly, there is denial. A bereaved person refuses to believe the news that their loved one has in fact died. And this stage can help a person to begin to deal with the shock and begin to collect the necessary defenses to deal with it. But each of these stages I am about to describe have unhealthy extremes which are generally produced from a failure to progress through the stages of bereavement. For example, the person who stops the process at denial can be found, and this is an extreme case, can be found keeping the dead corpse in their home for days on end, attempting still to speak with them and even to feed them. The third stage in this process is anger. And anger asks the question, why them? Why someone so good? Why someone so young? Why someone so close to me? And this is anger that can be directed towards doctors or nurses or other family members or friends and, of course, towards God Himself. Why did you allow this to happen? Sometimes that anger is directed towards the person who has died. They had no right to leave me alone. I needed them, their company, their help, their support. And when people do not work through this stage, a bitterness of spirit can result. And their anger is constantly being fueled to their own destruction. A fourth stage in the process is guilt. The bereaved person begins to blame themselves. I could have done more. I should have seen this coming. I should have picked up the symptoms. I should have read the signs earlier than I did. Or I should have shown more love, more understanding, more tenderness than I did to them. Paul Tournier has said, "There is no grave beside which a flood of guilt feelings do not assail the mind." And these guilt feelings are often without foundation. And again, where they are not worked through, They can lead people into unhealthy and depressive states, so that false guilt appears to the individual as a reality, and they can convince themselves that they are responsible for the death of their loved one. A fifth stage is that of disorientation and withdrawal. The bereaved person asks, "Where am I? What has happened to my life? What should I do now?" They no longer feel comfortable in society. Sometimes they cut themselves off from their normal social intercourse. They can't cope with the demands of society. C.S. Lewis described this reaction after the loss of his wife, and he wrote these words: "There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It's so uninteresting. Yet I want others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me." Again, if this stage is not worked through, people can end up being social recluses who permanently cut themselves off from social contact. There is a final stage which might be described as renewed activity and acceptance. And this is the place we find Joseph at the end of our passage. Now, this is not to be confused with a return to life as it was before. That is never possible. The bereavement process does not bring the dead person back. But rather, it's like a wound which has been healed over, but the scar is something we carry with us for the rest of our lives. There is, however, now at this stage, a new perspective on life and a recognition of the worthwhileness of pressing on into the future. Now, you might be asking, how in practical terms is that achieved? Elizabeth Elliot, who suffered the loss of two husbands, and you may remember that I mentioned one of those this morning, Jim Elliot, the martyr missionary to the Indians of Ecuador. Elizabeth Elliot suggests a number of steps which have helped her, and I must confess I find them extremely helpful myself. And I want to unashamedly deal with her points in turn this evening. First of all, she says there is value in pursuing the stillness of God's presence. And she points to Psalm 46, where the psalmist describes creation in a turmoil, creation that has been destabilized. Everything which has been so solid and dependable is falling away. And that's really not a bad description of how bereaved people feel. All that has been solid and dependable seems to be falling away before their eyes. Relationships which felt so secure are no longer there. Now, in the midst of the turmoil and change, it is of immense comfort, and this is the psalmist's discovery, to know that there is one thing that does not change. And at the end of Psalm 46, we have these glorious words of the psalmist. I'm sure I mentioned them recently. Verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Do you see what the psalmist is saying? In the midst of all this turmoil that one sees within the created order, all the change, one thing doesn't change. God doesn't change. Be still and know that I am God. There is a relationship that does not change. Secondly, she suggests that there is value in attempting to give thanks to God. Oh, I know, it's hard to give thanks for grief or loss and loneliness, but we can thank God for his presence with us in the midst of our trial. Severed from our loved one, but not from God's love. Thank you, Lord, for that. Attempt, she says, to give thanks to God. Thirdly, she urges the bereaved to refuse to be swamped by self-pity, which is one of the most paralyzing and self-destructive of all emotions. And it's hard to free ourselves from because we ourselves have purposefully chosen to wade out into this quicksand. And you see, the temptation in bereavement is to persuade ourselves that we are experiencing a greater burden than anyone has borne before. No one knows what it's like for me. Nobody has been in this precise position before. And it's so easy to lose sight of the fact that death is the common lot of man. Fourthly, she stresses the value of accepting one's aloneness. And this is probably one of the hardest things for us to do because God has created us as social beings. We have not been created to be alone. But loneliness has its uses, not least in drawing us closer to God himself and encouraging us to discover new resources and plumbing God's grace more deeply. And we need also to be able to offer our loneliness back to God. Think about it. If loneliness is a state that has been given to us by God, then it's only reasonable to offer it back to him to use and transform in his service as he wishes. Lord, you have made me lonely. Now use this loneliness in your service. Allowing God to work through our emptiness to the benefit of others. Finally, she suggests that we do something for someone else. Sounds awfully mundane, doesn't it? But again, I quote, there is nothing like definite, overt action to overcome the inertia of grief. When you think about it, most of us have someone who needs us. So that instead of turning in upon ourselves and asking for strength to cope, we can ask for strength to give away to others in what becomes self-forgetful service. And there is a sense in which at the end of this passage we find Joseph doing that. There are people back in Egypt who need my help. They need my administrative skill. he gives himself back to others. There is a very wonderful spiritual principle unfolded in Isaiah chapter 58, and I would encourage you to look this up, Isaiah 58, and reading in from verse 10. And if you spend yourselves on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will become like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. And it begins when you spend yourself on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed. You see what Isaiah is saying? When you stop becoming turned in upon yourself, natural as that emotion might be, and begin to recognize the needs of others, and reach out to them, and seek to minister to them, then God brings light to you in your darkness. Then God's blessing becomes increasingly apparent. Now, we are prone to argue, are we not? When we get our lives together again, we will be equipped to help others. But in actual fact, the reverse is closer to the truth. When we begin to give ourselves to others, we begin to get our lives back together again. When a loved one dies, there is a sense in which the lover also dies, or at least part of him or her dies inside. And part of Joseph was buried in Machpelah's cave. Part of us dies when we bury a loved one, be they parent or child. And the resurrection of believers on the last day is a great comfort to the grieving Christian. But there is another kind of resurrection which is no less a part of the Christian hope and no less a comfort. It is a resurrection that we can know here and now.